Hello and welcome to the Chartered Body Alliance podcast series. My name is Jo Murphy. I'm Chief Operating Officer at the Chartered Banker Institute, and I'm delighted to host today's episode, which will focus on sharing best practice in the development of organisations' mental health strategies, relevant not only in banking, but also across industries globally. This podcast series is delivered in partnership with the Chartered Banker Institute, Chartered Insurance Institute, and the Chartered Institute of Securities Investment. Together, we support the professional development and membership of over 200,000 financial professionals in the UK and globally. I'm delighted to be joined today by Jill White, Chief Customer Officer at CII, and Paul Barrett, Head of Wellbeing at the Bank Workers Charity. Jill, Paul, welcome.
Thanks, Joanne. Lovely to be here.
Hello there. Pleasure.
Hi, thank you both for offering to get involved and share your expertise. If we could just get into the sort of background to this, Paul, can I start with you, please? So, what does the current landscape look like regarding mental health in the workplace, and how have COVID and other circumstances affected this in recent years?
Right. Yes, it's a very interesting question because it's slightly more complicated than it appears. I mean, the first thing to say is from one perspective, organizations have made a transformational difference in the last 10 years in how mental health problems are handled within the workplace. Most organizations of any size have prioritized reducing the stigma, and that has made a massive difference. It's been incremental, it didn't all happen at once. But, if I'm looking at the landscape around mental health now within most major organizations, we work with banks a lot and we see it there. There's some brilliant practice. You have, it goes without saying, EAPs to provide the traditional psychological support group, but there's so much more built around that. So now we see business leaders talking about mental health, demonstrating that it's acceptable within the organization, almost giving people permission to be more open about it. And we're seeing this again and again. I do a lot of webinars in the banking sector. I'm often introduced by a line manager, and when we're talking about mental health as part of the webinar, they will often dive in. So that's so much more healthy than it used to be. But we have things like mental health first aiders, we have well-being champions, we have people that are responsible for developing well-being campaigns. I mean, Jill will know there's been a big movement, particularly in London. I don't know how much it's spread much beyond that, through a campaign that Barclays started called This Is Me, in which they got people with mental health problems to create videos of themselves, very brief videos, but very powerful, talking about their mental health problems, but in ways that didn't define them. And those campaigns have made a transformational difference, and they're long lasting. And, I can see that myself when we're doing mental health webinars across the banking sector. They're the most popular ones that we do. People get involved in open conversations at the end of the webinars in ways I honestly couldn't conceive of happening even 5 years ago. So really big differences. But what I would also say is that organizations are still dealing with unprecedented numbers of people coming through. And this is where it links into what you were saying about the pandemic. Pandemic had a massive influence on the mental health of so many people in the UK, children monumentally, but adults as well. And I think it was the Mental Health Foundation predicted that there'd be 500,000 new mental health cases for the NHS to deal with once the pandemic was over. Now, I haven't seen the precise figures, but the waves of people that are coming through have to be in those kind of numbers, I think. And so, what we're seeing through the pandemic was, or rather as a consequence of the pandemic, was big increases in common mental health problems like stress and anxiety. But also, there was an epidemic of burnout because people were faced with unprecedented levels of pressure and stress. They were trying to work from home, trying to fulfill the demands of a really busy job alongside perhaps shielding an elderly parent and thinking about both childcare and education for their kids, kind of things that nobody's had to deal with before. And of course, there were going to be repercussions from that. So lots of people really struggled. And I saw that all the time in the webinars that we were doing throughout the pandemic. So yes, great things happening within the banks and within corporations in general, but they're still having to deal on a daily basis to pick up the pieces of mental health problems that persist despite all of the big changes that they've made internally.
That's really interesting, Paul. Jill, can I just bring you in? I mean, what's your view? Do you think, you know, Paul's made these really relevant points about like the pandemic, what that has meant in terms of the referral rates and things like that we're seeing and the projections for that in the future. Do you think these trends will continue, or do you think they might settle down?
I think for now they're set to continue. It's now one in seven UK adults that are saying that their mental health is significantly more seriously affected than it was before the pandemic. And nearly 20% of women are struggling with poor mental health, with about 13% of men. So that's the most recent stats. And that's 33% up on the number of referrals for the NHS. And as we know, the NHS isn't set up to deal with this many people. So there's also people struggling out there who aren't being properly supported. And colleagues will fall upon organisations to look for support in those circumstances. So it's really important that all of our colleagues are trained and have the confidence to be able to have conversations. They mustn't take the place of a health professional, of course not, but they must be able to point and support the colleague to the right place, to the right tools, so that they can get the help that they want and need.
So lots of great initiatives out there that sort of Paul started to allude to try and tackle the problem, but not a problem that's going away anytime soon, and by the looks of it, could actually grow.
I think so. I mean, if we look at the numbers of teenage children waiting for mental health visits, I know several of my friends who've got teenagers who've been waiting, one in particular, been waiting 3 years. So this is the talent that's got to come through to the pipeline for our sectors. So this is set to continue for a significant period of time.
I can echo that around children's mental health, Jill, because it's one of the biggest issues that gets brought to our charity, because people are turning to charities in desperation because CAMHS, the mental health services for children and young people, are nowhere near being able to cope with the epidemic of mental health problems among young people and children.
And I think one of the factors there for employers as well is that, you know, my husband always says to me that you're only as happy as your unhappiest child. So, you know, adults in the workplace, actually, if you've got a child who's struggling, who has come through the pandemic in such an artificial environment to grow up as a teenager or young person in, then that is going to have an impact on their parents as well, who are employed in these organisations. So it definitely has a massive ripple effect, doesn't it, on everybody? And that's potentially why we're seeing that growth.
And I think it's important to recognise that this is a global issue. I do quite a lot of work in Hong Kong and Singapore, and they've actually renamed this generation of children the Strawberry Generation. And they're calling them the Strawberry Generation because they have no resilience and can be so easily squashed.
That's so sad. That's just so sad, isn't it?
Yeah. It's a reflection of, you know, it's the entire world is going through some form of this. And it's our future. So we need to all work together to support and resolve.
So let's talk about, you know, how we get to that support and how we get to supporting organisations to support their people here. So, you know, Paul, you deal with so many organisations, and you've seen, you know, lots of successful leaderships within the organisations and initiatives being developed. But do you believe we're equipping line managers of the future to deal with the scale of this problem?
I'm not sure we are. I think it's happening. It's happening in good organisations. I think there is training in place to help line managers of that key well-being role. And by the way, I don't just mean around supporting staff that come to them to say that they're experiencing mental health problems. That's vitally important, of course. But I'm talking about the wider well-being remit that line managers have, where they're responsible for exhibiting good well-being behaviors themselves, encouraging people to take lunch breaks, you know, kind of using the well-being resources that the organizations put at their disposal, promoting those programs, all of that kind of stuff as well. But I think only a minority of organizations are getting anywhere near training enough line managers. And that is, I think, absolutely central, because if you have an individual coming to their line manager and explaining that they've been diagnosed with clinical depression, for example, and that line manager knows enough about mental health and has the confidence because of that and the skills, the empathy, the sensitivity to deal supportively with that individual. Well, that individual, apart from feeling well supported, and obviously it will help build the relationship they have with their manager, they're much less likely to go off sick. And obviously that benefits the business as well as the line manager. And they're going to feel much more, you know, kind of generally good about the organization that they work for. Conversely, if the line manager, because they don't have good people skills, they don't understand mental health issues, they are frightened of having a conversation. And you know, I certainly encounter this a fair amount, where line managers steer away from a mental health conversation, not because they're uncaring, but they simply don't feel they have the knowledge and the understanding, and they fear that they'll make the situation worse. So it's key that line managers have training that equips them with that basic knowledge of common mental health problems, how to spot the signs that a member of their team might be struggling, knowing what resources to make available to them, and really importantly, how to have that conversation. And you know, Jill's already mentioned this. It's not about the line manager feeling they ought to be a counselor or a clinician of any kind. They don't need that. We're talking about very normal, caring language and pointing people in the right direction, about managers not getting sucked in deeper than they're capable of and finding themselves out of their depth, because that's partly what scares them in the first place. And good line manager training in mental health will give them all of those things and will make an absolutely massive difference.
That's a really good points that you've raised there, Paul. Jill, if I can just bring you in just now, you know, you've got great expertise in this area. What would you recommend for organisations who already have mental health support in place, but they need to build on it, or it isn't proven to be effective for them? What recommendations would you make to them?
Yeah, so I think the important thing here is not to tackle it as a tactical event by event problem, but actually to have a strategy around well-being, which obviously incorporates mental health. And so I wanted to, if you'll indulge me, to just talk about two frameworks that will be really useful to the people that are listening to us today. So one is the mental health at work commitment from MIND. And that's got six standards to give you a really holistic framework. And it declares, if you sign up to the commitments, it declares that your organisation is proud and keen to show that mental health matters. So it's a great EVP. So the six areas are: one, prioritising mental health in the workplace by developing and delivering a systematic programme of activity. Two, proactively ensuring work design and organisational culture deliver positive mental health outcomes. We all know that if the job design is poor and people don't understand their roles or where their accountability stops and someone else's starts, that can cause extreme stress. Three is about promoting an open culture of mental health, which we've already mentioned. Four is increasing organisational confidence and capability, which Paul has just talked about at length. And then five is providing mental health tools and support. And number six is increasing transparency and accountability through internal and external reporting. So really nice, easy to understand framework that you can sign up to, and there's loads of tools, videos, assets on the MIND website. And then the other one I wanted to mention was the CIPD's wellbeing assets. Again, another holistic framework for looking at wellbeing, and it covers five domains, very similar to MIND, but again, worth exploring. So their first domain is health. So obviously that's physical health, physical safety, mental health, and so on. And that's where a lot of strategies start and finish. But it's so much more than that, as we're already exploring. So the second one is work, your working environment, your line management, the demands of your work, your autonomy, how your organization manages change, your pay and reward. Financial health and financial well-being is absolutely imperative now, and all organizations have a part to play here, I think. And number three is values and principles. So this is about great leadership, demonstrating ethical standards and behaviors, and welcoming and embracing, celebrating diversity. And the fourth one is collective and social. That's about employee voice, people feeling that they can speak out and be heard, and they're a positive relationship at work where you feel you can say what you're thinking and you can ask for help. And positive relationships and trust is created. And then finally, personal growth. So lifelong learning, career development, this enable you to feel creative and emotionally stable and enjoy what you do every day, because work is so important to us, which is why the pandemic was such a problem, or partly such a problem for us. So I wanted to just share those two. There's obviously lots more out there, but it's this holistic approach and creating a strategy that covers all areas, I think, is certainly a great start.
It's really linking in there to psychological safety, isn't it? Like bringing your whole self to work, yeah, allowing you to be creative and the person that you want to be in the workplace and be respected and valued for who you are and the contribution you bring. And that's about creating that healthy working environment, isn't it? Where people can just be themselves, just treated as an individual.
Yeah, absolutely.
And fully. Thank you so much for sharing that, Jill. That was very, very useful. Paul, if I could come to you, because you work with so many different organisations, and I know you've done so many year on year, such a huge number of webinars and shared insight. But is there any sort of best practice that you've seen from organizations who have faced into these similar experiences or used any of these tools?
Generally speaking, banks that we work with have taken a very strategic approach to tackling mental health, and some of the most innovative initiatives and campaigns have come from them. I mentioned Barclays' This Is Me campaign. Santander did some fantastic campaigns too. They don't always spread virally in the way that the This Is Me campaign did, but they're all based on really solid research and taking a strategic approach to it. I did want to chip in with a couple of other things in relation to what we were talking about just now, though, which is, what Jill is saying is absolutely central. The foundation is taking a strategic approach, but some of the things that I think don't always happen as much as they should that make a difference, even in organizations that have got fairly good network of programs and resources in place, is that they get everything set up, but the communication isn't good enough. And the amount of times people come through to us as a charity and we end up telling them about things that are available in their own organization to support their mental health, because it hasn't been communicated as well as it ought to be. And I think lots of organizations can fall prey to that. They need to be putting it out there all the time, so people are constantly reminded. You've got new people coming into the organization that don't know. So the communication is as important as the presence of the programs themselves. The other thing is to remember that whilst we're focusing on mental health here, each individual's well-being is composed of lots of elements, and those elements interact with each other, as we know. So I would say, I was reading a report a couple of days ago about how organizations are addressing financial well-being. Now, it was a surprise to me that it was something like 38% of organizations were doing nothing, even though the organizations we work with have some amazing programs in place. There are still plenty of organizations that don't. And yet, I think Jill recognized this, financial well-being sorry, financial issues are one of the biggest impacts on mental health. There's been an amazing amount of research done on this. So one direct way would be for to improve things would be for organizations that aren't addressing financial well-being to be doing so, because that at a stroke would relieve a lot of the pressure and stress on a lot of people. And to be thinking not just about mental health in itself, but as in a holistic way about how different areas of mental health, if they remain unsupported, are going to have an impact in a negative way.
That's a really good point there, Paul. I think, it is about that. I think what really resonated with me is that the communication angle, because it is about that reinforcement. Because people are dealing with so much information, it's easy to get lost in it or not know where to look. So the signposting is essential for these initiatives, with for all the great work that people are doing and trying to make a difference in an organization, don't overlook the communication element of it. I think that's a really key sort of takeaway from there. Jill, we work in professions that are very much, the view is actually very much what gets measured gets done. So one of the questions I had for you is really, how do organizations measure employee well-being and mental health? And how often is reviewing it considered sort of best practice?
Yeah, so this is a difficult one because you should measure both internally and externally, but each organisation really needs to think about the outcome that it's seeking with the strategy that it puts in place. Because to Paul's point, different organisations are in very different places, different cultures exist. One organization may need to measure presenteeism because it has a particular problem with that. Another organization might be experiencing leavism, just as dangerous, subtly, subconsciously encouraged at times. So it will depend on what issues you've discovered as part of your strategy in order for you to then put the right KPIs in place. So what I would say is that what's vital is to make sure that you've got an evidence-based understanding of the causes of mental health issues at work and absence and unhealthy practices, and then identify what culturally and behaviourally is making those come about. So is it the fact that you're not performance managing people well, so they don't know where they are, everybody's being so nice to everyone, and not helping develop people when they need support. Is it because you've got this presenteeism where people don't go home till the boss goes home? Perhaps you're all based remotely, and a third of your workforce has very quietly checked out. And effectively disengaged and left. So you have to look at your own organization yourself, understand what the problems are, what's causing those problems, and then build the KPIs that will tell you that you're having an impact on those problems. From an external point of view, there's a voluntary framework that the government brought in a while ago where you can report on disability, mental health, and well-being. So I would actively encourage anything like that where there's voluntary reporting that you can do in your annual reports or whatever. You're then, as an employer, telling employees, prospective employees, that this matters to you and that you care about it, and it's more than just a tick box exercise. The other thing I would say is proactively carry out a work-related stress audit and then put in a preventative approach. So, for example, one of the things that we're just launching in my organisation is some teaching, some learning, some developments around positive psychology. So there are lots of things out there, such as, meditation, yoga, brilliant apps like Calm, that you can encourage people to use, and so on. But there's also some preventative learning, not just helping leaders understand how to have conversations, but actually people understanding positive psychology personally, I've studied it for years, is a really great tool, because actually you start to understand that everything is a choice. And once you understand your behavior and reaction is always a choice, it gives you control. So lots of different things to unpick there, but understand what your problems are and then build the solutions and therefore the right KPIs that can measure those solutions.
Thank you so much, Jill, for sharing that great insight with us. I suppose, unfortunately, finally, we talked a lot about the growing scale of the issues and the different approaches to support employers and employees. But do you think that there's any changes and improvements that we have seen across the profession in addition to what we've discussed today?
Yes, I really do. So I think if I think back to when I first started work, if I had been depressed or had anxiety or whatever, I would never have admitted that in a month of Sundays, because it wasn't considered to be a genuine illness. You would have been considered to have lacked resilience or even been determined as weak and ineffective. And now actually the stigma is definitely dissolving, if it not completely removed. People understand that mental health is an equal illness to a bad back, and people, and therefore colleagues need to be supported in exactly the same way with occupational health, adjustments made at work, flexible practices, and so on. So treated in exactly that same empathetic and supportive way. So that's a real positive that has come out, is that we're talking about it. There's a podcast about it. And there's lots of solutions and tools being created or already exist to help people. So I think that's a big tick in the box.
Brilliant. Thank you, Jill. And Paul, is that something that you would agree with? Is that something that you're
saying? Oh, absolutely. There is absolutely no comparison. In fact, I can give myself as a rather unfortunate example of somebody that had all sorts of misapprehensions about mental health 15 years ago. And what I was going to say was, I encountered that statistic that one in four of us will have a mental health problem in any given year. It's been around for a long time, and it probably remains true as it, compared to back then. But what my first reaction to that was, I'm in a small team here. It's only about 20 of us. Nobody's walking around with a mental health problem. And yet one in four is supposed to have a mental health. Don't buy it. And of course, it was an ignorant thing. It was based on ignorance. I didn't realize that people weren't talking about it because they would be too uncomfortable to talk about it, but also because an awful lot of people manage their mental health problems very successfully, and it doesn't prevent them having a really successful career. And so the fact that I wasn't seeing people walking around my office shouting about their mental health problems wasn't an indicator of anything other than what the climate was like back then. And yet it's very different now, where people will talk about their mental health problems. I've had colleagues go off work with mental health issues, and it's neither a stigma in the way that it used to be. People don't view them differently. They're viewed much more supportively. And that is a sea change and a very welcome one.
No, thank you for that. That great insight from you both, and lots of tools. Hopefully, people can take away. Sadly, that's all we've got time for today. I hope that our audience has enjoyed the podcast and can adopt some of this best practice and utilize some of these strategies discussed in your own organization. I'd like to thank our fantastic panel, Jill and Paul, for sharing their insight and expertise. You've been absolutely terrific, and it's a topic that isn't going away. I'm sure we'll come back to share most best practice and more challenges in the future. But thank you so much again for your insight and sharing best practice with us. Until next time, thank you and goodbye.